Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of PageCast. My name is Chris Gibbons, and my special guest today is journalist, TV producer, best-selling author, Graham Kutzer. Graham, welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Chris, thanks so much for having me. Lovely to join you.
Graham's latest book, and it's already been labelled a bestseller and a NASPERS Book of the Month, is Zama Zama, Inside the Illicit Mining Underworld. Graham, it sounds exciting.
Chris, I certainly hope readers find it that way. To me, it's a very dark, dangerous side of the South African of life in South Africa that we don't often see. To a degree, it was certainly an adventure telling some of these stories, but also an important one. I think a story bringing to light was the idea, bringing to light things that stay very much hidden in the dark.
You've been working on this particular project, the Zama Zama project, if I can call it that, for the best part of 15 years?
Certainly have. Certainly not 15 years continuously, but over the years have done really quite a lot of stories for Carte Blanche, where we delved into all the layers of the illicit mining world.
Okay, everyone knows that Zama Zamas are illegal miners, working a few abandoned mine shafts around Johannesburg. Nothing to get too worked up about, surely.
Certainly what I thought originally. And to a degree, some of what of that question is actually true till today. It really is. It starts at the very lowest levels. It's people who would mostly have been working on mines before have now run into, for whatever reason, closure of mines, job cuts, the works, have run into financial difficulties. But what we've seen over the last sort of 20, 30 years really increase is that very organized crime syndicates realized that these people that were going underground initially just to make enough money to sort of pay for their own, you know, pay the bills kind of thing, could be exploited to make millions. So where you've got a group of 10 guys maybe working a little abandoned shaft and making 20,000, 30,000 rand a month, if I could have 100 guys at 10 different shafts making 100,000 rand for me, and I'm paying them very little, then it becomes very lucrative. And that to me is what's happened here in the past sort of 20, 30 odd years.
I was astounded when I read the book at the breadth of the criminality that pervades this entire operation through things like VAT. Hmm. Explain the how it works.
I must say that to me was an astounding, astounding revelation. Many years ago, in the early 2010s, I think we did that story, started investigating that story in 2013. What we found was that Zama Zamas and people smuggling gold across our borders from neighboring countries into South Africa were being paid more than the actual daily spot price of gold for smuggled or stolen gold.
So let me get this right. I smuggle an ounce of gold or 100 ounces of gold or whatever, and it's going at the moment $4,500 US dollars per gram. You're going to pay me $4,500. You're going to pay me more
than that daily spot price.
How does that work?
And that was the question, right? So that's where myself and a colleague who worked on that story at the time was like, that's impossible. Typically, when we see stolen goods being sold on the black market, it wouldn't be at a premium. If I've stolen a TV and I'm selling it to you, I'm not going to charge you what the big retailers are charging. I'm going to charge you half the price kind of thing. So why was that happening? And after what ended up being nearly, I think, about a year and a half investigation, we were able to crack this. And what it turned out to be was the main driver behind illicit gold at the time was this massive VAT scam. So what the guys were doing, I could pay you the spot price plus a few percentage points. Say what the guys in the underworld were talking at the time, the kind of lingo you were hearing was, Chris, I'll give you spot plus two, spot plus three for your gold, which meant 2 or 3% above the daily gold price. And why they were able to do that is they were taking that illegally bought gold, laundering it into the legitimate economy, and then claiming VAT on it. Now, VAT at the time, as you would know, was 14%. So that left you, even if you paid 2 or 3% over the spot price, that the rest of that 14% was pure profit that you could claim back after legitimizing the gold.
Sounds like a wonderful business, but there's always a but in this. To claim the VAT back, you need an invoice.
Yeah.
Where did the invoices come from?
So what they were doing is they were taking the gold that they'd illicitly obtained through smuggling or through zamazamas or whatever the case may be, and saying this was second-hand gold that I'd bought from Chris or I'd bought from Graham, who'd come into my little shop and sold me a gold ring or some gold earrings, etc., etc. Under the Secondhand Goods Act at the time, they needed to legitimize that transaction, your copy of your ID, and they needed an invoice to say they'd paid for this gold. And we were like, how are they doing this? So around this illicit gold economy, a whole cottage industry had grown, people that they'd invoice farms, people that they were employing to sit there and make up the invoices. So if I'd bought a kilogram of illegal gold for a day, I needed someone to sit and write out invoices and for like grams of a gold ring, a wedding ring or whatever the case may be, making up 1 kilogram of gold that I'd supposedly bought from the public. They were buying ID books. At the time, we were told 15, 20,000 rand for a DVD or CD with about 15,000 copies of 15,000 ID books on. So they had your ID number. And by the way, I was astonished to find at the time that me and our ID books might have been used in those scams. They had the paperwork to back it up. Because remember, if SARS ever came to audit you, you needed to show that you'd supposedly bought this on this as secondhand gold. So just an amazing, I mean, we found housewives doing it, pastors, the works, working as these invoice writers, making up invoices to back up, to create the fake paper trail.
But then I'm sitting in SARS and I get this mountain of invoices for a VAT refund. Yeah. That Tunny so-and-so has sold her gold earrings, Wim so-and-so has sold his wedding ring, etc. And it happens again and again and again. Surely an alarm bell goes off inside SARS.
It certainly did. And by the time our investigation was coming sort of to a close, we went to SARS and showed them what we'd had. And they were at the time quite willing to speak to us and actually revealed that they'd been busy with the same kind of investigation. In fact, so much so that they had picked up on us and they were lobbying government at the time to change and to amend that the was called the notional input tax on secondhand gold. It did happen briefly after our story, by the way, and about a year later, it did happen for, I think, about a year, and then changed back again.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. So ended up running the VAT scam for many, many years, and some other journalists and other news publications have and done fantastic work on that. And, I mean, the claims that SARS has made against a single company, by the way, in court papers, show that they reckon about 22 billion rand.
That's billion with a B.
Billion with a B was laundered through that VAT scam using the exact same method we've just discussed over a period of, I think, between 2012 and 2021, 2022, something like that.
Suddenly those kind of numbers make really big sense in terms of a criminal racket. I mean, that's absolutely not to be sneezed at all.
Certainly not.
Is it still happening?
Still happening. The method has changed. Now it has a lot to do with how you export the gold. Still a lot of the VAT claims in on exports. It's a different way of doing it, but similar results. But just smuggling in general is still the whole illicit trade, because there's so many levels where people can make money at. From the zamas to the middlemen, who would be the buyers between zamas or smugglers and the bigger buyers, etc. There's so much money to be made along every sort of little step along that chain or link along that chain that I can't see it going away anytime soon.
How difficult was it from the perspective of a journalist, a TV producer, how difficult was it to put this together, to penetrate into the world of the zamas?
I think that's where we took it a step further, right? Especially what I think Carte Blanche has done fantastically over the years, and it's certainly not me, it's a team of people working behind it. I did a lot of these stories, but What we've been able to do is unpack things that you would typically only see in a news piece for 2 or 3 minutes and really sort of get to digest that and spend the time investigating. So I think in many cases I was very lucky. I was always very careful, but we were able to, over the past 16 years, get incredible access. And I think a lot of what I love about the book is not because it's not just telling the sort of the news side of the story. It's telling readers how we got to do it. We met incredible characters. I speak about an anonymous source called Pineapple, a guy who was doing cash and he was at the time one of the top sort of he was the only guy you could go to if you'd pulled off a cash in transit heist. And you had those cases that those vehicles usually travel and carry around with them. To open those is quite a story, apparently, because if they're booby-trapped. If you open them, there's ink that splatters. It's supposed to splatter you and destroy the cash or make the cash unusable. Pineapple was a man who could open these for these cash in transit gangs. I met him quite a few years later through a policeman who'd arrested him for that at the time. And then he turned state witness and was working with the police. But by the time I met him, Pineapple was running one of the biggest Zama sites in Gauteng at the time, a place just outside of Springs. And I promise you, a 5-minute drive from a very main road between Johannesburg and Springs, where it looks like felt from the outside. And you drive in, and I dubbed it Gold City in the book. And you drive in, and it's a little village. It's a little town. Hundreds of people. I was told thousands. I never saw thousands, but I certainly saw hundreds of people working in Zama land, making a whole living around. And again, all those levels. So it's people supplying them with food, drinks, etc. There's people supplying the equipment needed to do mining. There's people doing the processing of the gold. So when it comes up, it's all just rock and sand. That needs to be processed. So there's processing facilities. It was this whole village. Pineapple, this crazy guy that we met, the real gangster look, by the way. I think it's something in the gold industry. If you're in that world and it's thick gold bands, thick gold necklaces, drinking double brandy and Cokes at 10 in the morning when I met him in the world's dodgiest bar. And just fascinating characters along that road. And getting to know guys like it, building up trust with them, and being very honest about what we wanted to do. I tried not to lie to people. I try and tell them, look, we're telling a story about illegal gold. You've also got a side to it. We want to tell your side of the story.
We laugh about it. We smile about it. Characters like Pineapple sound hilarious. Mm. They're actually deadly dangerous. They'll kill you if you put a foot wrong.
It's certainly not a world where you want to go. And I can tell you now, and I've looked at it, it's not in the book, but there's quite a few cases. When you hear of some hit happening in Cape Town, there's a major one just happened a week ago or in the last few days, yeah. But in Joburg, whatever, it's typically not just some random hit. And it's also not always just gang warfare. Usually, it's someone, I can promise you, working in one of our big illicit trades, gold being one of them, certainly, drugs, counterfeit goods, you name it, illicit tobacco. And by the way, all those sort of networks seem to crisscross each other at some point along the line. But absolutely deadly dangerous. In the gold world, you have fights for control of shafts. Because there's value in it, right? So, and again, those Zamas that go underground, if you're in control of the shaft, I can't come and work your shaft. I need to pay for that privilege. I'll probably pay you for the privilege of being sent down. I'll pay you for the equipment I'm going to need. I'm going to give you a very big cut of my whatever I bring up there. And we've actually met and spoken to and interviewed Zamas who've ended up after 3-4 months of what I would describe as a life I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, underground like it, who've come up owing the syndicates money. Which is just, I mean, I sat there just absolutely flabbergasted after. But anyway, it's those guys that make it deadly because I want your shaft. And I'll go to absolutely ruthless lengths to take it. And that is bribing police to work for me to go and harass you on your site anything from that to you having small militias. Guys, and I've seen this with my own eyes, 20, 30 guys armed to the teeth, AK-47 rifles, hand grenades, RPG, rocket-propelled launchers. The kind of stuff that you would see in a modern-day army. That's what they're armed with. And it's literally a small militia. You can't send two or three policemen in a soft-skinned vehicle to try and address an issue like that.
What role, I mean, you've said bribe a policeman. What role is played by the police in all of this?
It's often that, unfortunately, what you can go to any Zom. I have not been to a single one where they didn't complain, not about arrests, about police wanting bribes. It's often a problem. Paying police, low-level policemen in general at Zama sites, paying so constables, patrol officers, that kind of thing, paying them to drive around there or so in the police vehicle, right? Because who's going to pull over a police vehicle and search it? Paying them for protection, paying bribes to leave them to, you know, to let them carry on with their work. So it's, yeah, unfortunately, not the greatest stories you hear about the police. On the other hand, I have a lot of sympathy for any policeman who has the unenviable task of trying to take on one of these. Let's say we identify a shaft, we know there's 100 armed guys there, and we are the police that have to go in and sort this problem out. It's not like walking up to someone's house and knocking on the door and saying, I'm the police and I'm here to arrest you. These people have lookouts. There's almost always some very tall sort of mountain, old abandoned mine heap, et cetera, they'll have lookouts all along. They'll see any law enforcement coming from miles away. They're armed to the teeth. They have a getaway by going underground. No one can follow them then. Those areas, they booby trap, but they know that the underworld, the underground, the literal underground, tunnels, like the backs of their hands, where how are we as untrained police, number one, even going to try and get in there, and then number two, try and arrest people there. So it's, I do have a lot of sympathy for anyone trying or with that task to try and sort out that problem.
We've had stories, I think it was about a year ago, 18 months ago, somewhere around there, of Zama-Zamas being trapped underground and dying underground.
Yeah. It's a story we covered as well, and one that sort of personally hit me in many different ways, because I'd been to that very site. So it's it's an old mine called Biffle's Mine, which in 2015 was under attack. So the first time I visited Biffle's Mine was 2015 on a carte blanche story where they were trying to decommission the mine. They were trying to be the first mine in South Africa to successfully decommission, completely environmentally rehabilitate, et cetera, right? Which is what we want our mines to do. But they were under nightly attack. Groups of 100 people or more, armed to the teeth again, just coming in, going underground into the shafts, but also just stripping anything on the mine that was already being sort of deconstructed, stripping anything of value. So copper, steel. I mean, we saw, it's just incredible. And the scale of it. So the typical vandalism we're seeing in small towns today, but on a scale that you couldn't believe. I mean, it looked apocalyptic. The scenes were completely apocalyptic. Imagine some of the biggest buildings being torn down and at night just groups of hundreds of men taking massive cables and massive steel poles, et cetera, et cetera. But strangely, you know, at the time, number 10 shaft was one of the areas where the security took us to and said, when there's inter-gang rivalry between different groups of illegal miners, and shootings happen, 10 shaft is where they throw the bodies down. And we stood at the edge of 10 shaft and looked down. And I think 10 shaft was about 1.5, 1.8 kilometers straight down shaft by this. Many levels as you go along, but a shaft that vertically goes down into the earth for 1.5, 1.8 kilometers. And they said, no one will ever find these bodies because no one's ever going to go down there. It's too dangerous. The shaft is closed, et cetera, et cetera. So fast forward 10 years to 2025, late December 2024, the police under Operation Vala Umgodi, which was a nationwide operation by police and the SANDF working together to take on illegal mining, had come to Stilfontein and closed down many of those illegal shafts, blocking access to them. During that, I think in excess of 1,500 illegal miners surfaced and were arrested for being illegally trespassing, many of them foreign nationals who were in the country illegally, etc., etc. But reports started surfacing late 2024 that about a group of 200-300 people were stuck at a shaft, Shaft 11. So Shaft 11, as the crow flies, 2-3 kilometers from Shaft 10. Shaft 11. By the time we got there in January 2023, there was a massive court, 2025, there was a massive court case by civil society. We took on the minister and the police and said, we need to send down a rescue team. People are dying down there. By the time we got there and the media got there and carte blanche as well, was early January 2025. I think about 74 people had died underground. So they were trapped. It was absolutely, when they released those videos, some of the miners stuck down below had sent up videos, and I believe it was to Lawyers for Human Rights at the time. It just showed rows of bodies trapped underground. Those miners were stuck 1.2 kilometers underground. Rows of bodies wrapped up. And I can't imagine that scene, being stuck under there, having no food, no water, no access to anything for months or weeks, dead bodies. I mean, it's really hot. The deeper you go underground, the hotter it gets. And in legitimate mines, you'll have air conditioning and you'll have all the – these old mines don't have it. So, yeah, it brought the human side home. I spoke to a mother there whose son had gone down with having no job opportunities and who's never been found again. So we don't know if he died in that. He wasn't one of the bodies that was found at the time, but he's never been found again. So most likely did come to, you know, his end underground somewhere. But what was one of the sort of most surreal moments during that whole thing for me is we met Zama, who had managed to escape. Christmas Day 2024. Up Shaft 10, that same shaft where we'd been told 10 years earlier that no one would ever go down there. So what he did was he was amongst the miners that was trapped at Shaft 11 and just said to himself, I'm not going to die here. And somehow, and still had the energy left, somehow managed to make his way underground from Shaft 11 where many of those men died. I think he said it took him about 3 hours, 2.5, 3 hours, to Shaft 10. Now, Shaft 10 had nothing to climb up. There was no more elevator. The mine's been closed for more than a decade. He physically used the steel frame that the shaft cage used and climbed up that cage and described this journey as just something horrific. As he was climbing up this 1.5-kilometer journey, found dead bodies. Some of them he described as skeletal remains, and I wondered, were those some of the victims that had been thrown down there many years earlier, but also fresh bodies, unfortunately. So other Zamas probably at the same time who tried to make their escape up that route and had fallen, slipped, and come to their deaths. And listening to him describe that journey and what it must have taken him to make it out was just something else. It really brings home that there, despite the violence I've seen in the illegality around illegal mining, there's also a very human element to it.
Have you, Graham, been down a Zama Zama shaft?
Quite a few. Some I don't fit, I'm not going to lie. I describe a story in the book. One of the first I wanted to go down, the guys laughed at me. The Zamas themselves laughed at me and said, no, you're way too big, you won't fit. And I actually asked them, I had my personal camera there today. It was a research part, it wasn't part of our filming for the show. and asked him to go film for me, and he took the camera down, and it's just incredible to see the footage. Did a fantastic job, by the way. He missed his calling, the man, but brought back footage where you could see how they had to fit through. The mine had blocked the shaft, so up until a point, I probably would have fit. But the mine had blocked the shaft with massive pieces of concrete, et cetera, et cetera. And these almost made it through areas that I promise you a contortionist couldn't. But since then, quite a few times have gone really deep into those tunnels, into the shafts with them. It's something else.
How does this end? Or does it end? Does it just continue?
I don't see it ending anytime soon. There's still a lot of gold down there. When you're doing it illegally, you can make money off of it. So people often, the one big question people ask, well, if all the gold mines are closing, why is there, but there's still gold left, why is illegal mining happening? Well, the legal gold operations have to spend billions in health and safety and employees and deal with unions and deal with government laws and et cetera, et cetera. The illegal side doesn't have any of that. Which means there's still a lot of gold down there that can be done, that can be removed, and can be, you can make billions, as we know, billions in profit from it. I don't see it going anywhere. I don't see it being addressed at the very high levels where people, sort of the white-collar criminals, are laundering it, using it for money laundering it, putting it into the legitimate market and making billions from it. And I don't see it... I don't see people like the Zamas and these crime syndicates running them, walking away from their millions either.
Graham, what is your next project?
I don't have one exactly now. I'm working on a documentary, by the way, that we hope will sell. That we're hoping to sell to the international market. Myself and my business partner, Nikki Troll. Also, by the way, completely coincidentally, it has to do with gold and what we think was one of the biggest gold heists to ever happen in South Africa many, many moons ago. And it's a fantastic story about the criminal who pulled it off. He did go to jail for it and is now willing to tell his story. And the policeman who caught him.
I look forward to seeing it. Graham Kutzer, author of Zama Zama. It's a fantastic book, by the way. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and it gets a highly recommended rating from me. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.